Hello and welcome to Sofa Sensei's. You're joined by me, Kavan, and this is the Aki and Saltfish Digital Network. Today, we have a very special guest. His name is Christian Davis, and he is a researcher from the University of Leicester studying boxing and urban identities. His research gives an account of social structures within a local gym serving ethnic minority communities. It aims to understand how race, gender, social class, and masculinity intersect to affect inclusion and exclusion in this space, and how local sports clubs and local communities influence the construction of urban identities. If that doesn't fascinate you, I don't know what will. I'm really excited to get stuck into this one. So without further ado, let's go. Wow. So, first of all, thanks for joining me, Christian. How are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm great, thanks. What a great introduction, and thank you for having me on. You know, this is a great podcast. I've been watching a few of the episodes, and yeah, you're doing some brilliant work.
Appreciate it, man. Thank you very, very much. And just to give the listeners some background, I always like to let people know how easy or difficult guests were to book. And this story all stems from a building that I work in. A colleague of mine let Christian in the room. And I noticed Christine had a slightly different lanyard to her. So I said to my colleague, who's that? She said, oh, no, he just comes in. He works every now and then. You know, he's a really lovely, lovely guy. So, you know, we let him in. I said, okay, cool. And then we got talking. And I noticed, I think he had a University of Leicester lanyard on. So I said to him, look, I went to the University of Leicester. What are you doing there? And sort of, what are you doing here? And he explained about his research in boxing and gyms and identities. And actually, my degree was in sociology, intersecting in gyms and identities. My dissertation was around why some people post images from the gym and others don't. I was really interested in why, like, for example, I don't really post that I go to the gym, but some people, it's part of their daily routine. I found it really fascinating. And then when you spoke about boxing, first thing I thought of was, of course, Sofa Senseis. So, you know, tell us about your start in that field. What sparked your interest in that?
Okay, so I haven't got a long boxing history. I've been participating in boxing for, I'd say, about 6 years, which, you know, it isn't too long. But I've always been a fan of boxing. And I've always wanted to kind of, you know, develop myself as a person. Growing up, I wasn't really, you know, the academic type. Admittedly, I was quite naughty in school. I wasn't really, I wanted to go as far to say that I was a bad kid, but you know, I was a little silly. But again, you start to mature and you try to, you try to build in yourself as you mature. And, you know, I found myself in university, first person from a family to go to university. And I just kept, yeah.
Let's give that some props, man.
Thank you. Yeah, and I just kept going with it, to be honest. And eventually I went on to do a master's after my undergrad. And then you kind of bump into the right people at the right time. And my supervisors at the moment, which I believe I've actually taught you in Leicester, John Williams.
Definitely.
I kind of got to speak into these, you know, these right people, and they kind of guided me into, you know, the kind of field. Now, they specialise in sports, so the sociology of sports, particularly football, which is also a big passion of mine. But, you know, reading into kind of the sociology of sports, I've noticed that there was a kind of absence of literature within boxing and the sociology of boxing. Now, boxing research that is out there currently, it heavily stems on, you know, clinical work, things that are, you know, testing, you know, brain injury, what punches do to the brain, also physical aspects of boxing as well, how to improve, you know, your cardiovascular fitness through boxing and things like this. But I noticed that there wasn't actually much literature on, you know, the social side to boxing. And again, the first time I met you, one of the first questions you asked me was, have you read Loic Wacant's work, you know, Body and Soul?
Yeah.
And Yeah, that is quite seminal within this field of work. And I wanted to not emulate something like that, but do something similar. Because again, there is a lot of work in the States on boxing. A lot of the sociology of boxing is done within the States. So I wanted to bring that to the UK, to a local gym, and see what these kind of gyms mean to the local community. So that's kind of how I started, meeting the right people at the right time. Through self-development.
That sounds, there's so many things I want to unpick there. Let's start with the Body and Soul book by Wakant.
Yeah, sure.
For me, once I finished my degree, I got more into sociology, which is weird, I guess. I started to find avenues of it that I was more interested in, like the sociology of sport and sociology of boxing. That book is an ethnography of, I think it's Chicago, if my memory serves me right.
Yeah, that's right.
And he travels through these gyms and he literally is training to be a boxer. And what he does is he gives us an account of, some of the boxers that he interacts with, their identities, their trials, their tribulations, but also he goes through their careers as well and what their careers do to their identities. So you have some fighters, and at the start of the book, these fighters, they want to become champions, like the champions that have gone before them in Chicago. But then, they have losses early on in their career, and those losses compound, and that shifts their identity. And now they're not training as hard as they used to. Or often, what he spoke about was these guys are training really, really hard in the gym, that by the time they get to the fight, they're spent. And that's really, really interesting because where do you spend your best energy? And actually, in part two of our conversation, one of the questions we ask all of our guests is, you are at your best when you are. And actually, sometimes, people talk about their confidence or their balance. And Wakant goes through how one shift in this person's outer life can really affect what happens in the gym and therefore in the ring. And that can have, sometimes dire consequences. A fascinating, fascinating book. And I'm conscious that this obviously isn't a sociology podcast. So let's break down what sociology looks at and why that is a lens that you want to look at boxing through.
Well, sociology, in a nutshell, it's looking at people, it's looking at society, it's looking at interactions, and that's exactly what I'm doing in my research. So I'm going into one specific gym. I won't name the gym. Got to keep that kind of confidential. But I'm going in there and just interacting with the people, just like Wakan done to the people of Chicago who went in there and he spent time with these people. That's exactly what I'm doing. It seems simple, but you can learn a lot just from conversations, just from observing, even just living the life what they're living like. So I'll be there training amongst these people. To them, this is what they do, on a day-to-day basis. They turn up, they train, and I put myself in their shoes by turning up, training alongside them. For ethical reasons, I couldn't do what Wakan done and become a boxer, but still I could experience what they're feeling by training alongside them. And again, just trying to blend in as one of the boxers. Now, this is what you call an ethnographical study. So I use a method which is called ethnography. And to break that down, that is pretty much what I've just explained. So I'm placing myself in the shoes of others. I'm actually living, the life that they live, and creating knowledge through experience, through first-hand experience, which is quite important. A lot of studies they may observe, but that disregards the feeling of being there and actually living it. So the lived experience, and that's quite important here. So that's the type of sociology that I'm kind of using and kind of looking at. So again, interactions, dealing with people, on a small scale, I guess.
So earlier you spoke to the importance for you of self-development, and I wonder if you can sort of take me back and, you know, explain why that is such a central part of this research and your identity. And when did that occur? Because, you know, you mentioned your school life and, you know, your behavior in particular could have been better in school, but that doesn't necessarily mean there's an absence of self-development. So when did you notice that self-development thread was part of who you were?
So with the self-development, it was a case of, I felt deep down that I wasn't really fulfilling my potential.
Right.
Again, I left school with minimal GCSEs. I couldn't really get a job because, you know, I wasn't really in the right place with hardly any qualifications. I had to go to college to get some extra qualifications just to put me on like the foundation stage, just to get in the position to even go to university. And it was through kind of role models, positive role models, that put me on this right path, because as a young kid, you don't really, a lot of young people don't really know what they want to do in life. And I was, you know, in that kind of position. I also was kind of, I felt that I needed to, display this kind of character, this stereotypical young, you know, black kid, you know. I'd actually kind of play up to that at a certain age. But again, speaking to the right people, someone from a family actually, which was one of my late dad's cousin, he told me, you know, Chris, why don't you do something that you enjoy, get into sports? Because originally I actually wanted to become a bricklayer, believe it or not. I thought, okay, there's a bit of money here. I can just, you know, find myself a trade. And this is, you know, there's nothing wrong with bricklaying, you know, it's a good trade. But for me, it just wasn't for me. In during winter times, I'm there picking up bricks and it's hard in the hands and it's freezing. I'm like, wow, it's not for me. I'm not built that way. So this role model, he said, do something that you enjoy. So what do you enjoy? And I was thinking, you know what? I do enjoy sports. At the time I was playing football quite a lot. And I thought, yeah, let me go and enroll college. That's exactly what I'd done. And again, at this point, I wasn't thinking, okay, let's go on this journey of self-development. Mm. I was still a young kid. I was enjoying doing sports. And then somehow kind of scraped through college and I managed to get into university, went to the University of Wolverhampton. And even sports of his. I wasn't really the model student. But I got to university and I said to myself, okay, I'm at a stage now where I need to kind of, you know, book up my ideas and, you know, and start to get my head down in these books. Because I felt that maybe it's a bit of imposter syndrome, but I felt that I wasn't kind of good enough to even be in university at the undergrad level, because I scraped through college and I thought, wow, university is going to be tough. So I worked so hard, and just through hard work, I actually managed to get a first class degree. And I couldn't believe it. Yeah, I could not believe it. And that was the first kind of moment where I thought, well, I felt proud. I felt proud of myself. And how did I get a first? And then this was kind of the start of the journey, because I actually won an award at the time. And literally this all just came within like a matter of a few weeks. I won an award of Student of the Year at the time at undergrad. And for me, this was the person that was come from, you know, relative poverty, and I haven't really, you know, had much backing. Again, none of my family are academics. I've got this first. And then one of my lecturers at the time, Richard Medcalf, he actually said to me, Chris, Have you ever thought about doing a master's? And I was thinking, master's? What, me? Like, what? I couldn't believe it. Like, nah, people like me, we don't really, even just to go to university, that is enough. But to go on to do a master's, I wouldn't even have even thought about doing that. But yeah, I had some time to think. Initially, I didn't actually choose to do the master's. I tried to get a job, but I couldn't even get a job with a first class degree.
That's real. That's very
Couldn't,
real,
yeah, I
yeah.
couldn't even get a job. So yeah, I did a master's the year after, and again, this was going to be a challenge. So I said to myself, I'm going to try my best. I just need to try and pass this, whatever I do, I need to try and pass this. Funnily enough, I actually found the master's a lot easier than my undergrad. Now,
Why?
that was because this was because the undergrad, I went into this not knowing anything about journal articles, about reading academic literature, about bit thinking and writing critically, any of these skills. So I went into the master's having some form of idea about writing and reading. And I actually done well in my master's. I actually got, again, a distinction at a master's level.
Collecting
And
these
now this,
accolades.
yeah, again, I don't know how, well, I didn't know how.
Yeah.
But again, I didn't believe in myself. So yeah, I got a distinction and a first. So at this point, I thought, wow, should I start believing in myself?
Yeah.
Am
So
I
someone was telling you
kind of
something.
lacking on me?
Yeah.
Yeah. So again, coming from this silly guy in school that was just trying to bush job with my mates, and then it's just a case of, okay, now I've got 2 degrees. And what I followed here was one of my lecturers from my master's, who was my dissertation supervisor. He actually said to me, Chris, have you ever thought about publishing your master's dissertation? So I thought, okay, yeah, that's the next step. And this is when I thought, you know what, let's go down this route. I need to start, developing myself and stick with academia. It is kind of, it's been nice to me at the moment, academia is. So yeah, I ended up co-publishing with my dissertation supervisor, Stephen Lawrence, at Newman University. And yeah, so that's my first publication. So by this stage, from being in school, failing, going into the bricklaying, failing that, and now I've actually started to do something that I enjoy, because if I remember, I enjoy sports. I should have mentioned that I've done PE and sports studies at master's level.
Right.
Yeah, so now I'm actually starting to develop myself, and I can actually be proud of myself,
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So what was next? What was next? So I needed to start networking, because I wanted to kind of get this publication out there and present this research that I've just done. And by chance, I went to a conference to present my work, and I bumped into Paul Campbell, who's my current PhD supervisor. We just got talking, and his work, it stems on, race and football and race and sports. And again, so we're in the same field, and he kind of took me under his wing also. And he told me, a lot of good advice. I told him that, I always wanted to do a PhD, and that's kind of where I'm at now. So currently I'm doing PhD at the University of Leicester. And that kind of brings us to, this research that I'm going to tell you about.
So a few things I want to pick up on, and I don't think this should be understated whatsoever, is that resilience, fortitude, one step at a time, and a few of the phrases that spring to mind on that basis are almost like a reluctant academic. I was at a conference the other day and someone stood up and said, I'm a reluctant academic, but I'm passionate about thing. And it was fascinating listening to your story there and the way your identity eventually became a sort of willing academic. You know, you're someone who's now in the field, and I think there's some super potential there for you to be the role model that you were looking for when you were younger. Like, it's exactly. so clear to me right now.
Yeah. I just realised I went on a bit of a tangent there.
No, it works.
But exactly. That is, I'm kind of becoming who I wish that I kind of needed.
Yeah.
Now, on the side of, because I teach also as a GTA at the University of Leicester, and obviously I'm doing my research, but on the side I do some mentoring also for a non-profitable organisation in the West Mids, which is Motivate Youth.
Nice.
Now, I'm kind of using, you know, my presence and my background and my past to kind of uplift some of these young people. And it's exactly what I, again, like you said, that I kind of needed.
Yeah.
And I kind of developed into, you know, this person. And to be honest, I'm still, right now, I'm still developing. So I'm not the finished product currently, but I'm getting there.
But that's the I think that's the relatability of it, though. When you're not the finished product, people can see a piece of themselves in you. When you've got it all locked down, people don't see a root in that. People think, oh, okay, that's you. That's only you. That can't be me because I'm not finished yet. So we almost need to see that unfinishedness in each other for us to be able to relate. And I think that's really, really important that we get that across. All those failures, all those, you know, attempts at being something else drew you closer to what you were. And I think that's a lesson that a lot of us could learn. Often we beat ourselves up for not knowing what we want to do or who we want to be. But often in traversing that landscape, by, like I say, doing more of what you don't want to do should bring you closer to what you do want to do. And there is some real, real lessons in that. I wanted to talk a little bit about your identity as a man.
Yeah.
You spoke earlier about being a black man. And I just want to know any reflections you've got in terms of, you alluded to some earlier, in terms of your sort of educational experiences as a black man and how that informed how you navigated the space. How has that improved as you navigated through higher education? Or I'm assuming it has improved, right? It sounds like it has, but has it improved while navigating through higher education?
That's a great question. I think my sense of self has improved through, you know, just learning, you know, just reading, and even like my own research. My research is about, you know, racialized identities also. So again, I'm doing a lot of reading into race and ethnicity. But to be honest, it is quite frustrating. It is quite frustrating. Again, I'm just kind of trying to get my foot into the door, in terms of, you know, academia and teaching at least. But it is quite difficult because the higher you kind of go with it, with education, the less diverse it seems.
Yeah.
Now, as an undergrad, had maybe, I think there's three black students in my class.
What did you say? PE?
This was sports studies.
Sports studies, wow.
Sports studies. And then I went on to the PE and sports studies, and I was the only black person in my class there. And just looking around at the faculty, you know, in universities, it is heavily white, you know, and, you know, these higher positions, again, I'm nowhere near these higher positions, but already can see that they are, it's quite dominated by, you know, white males, you know, straight white middle class men.
Yeah.
And it's quite frustrating. I saw a statistic not too long ago that I think there was 0.6% of UK professors are black, so that's
Yes.
less than 1% of
Yeah.
UK professors. Again, I'm some way off professorship, well, a long way off, but that is quite disheartening if for an academic to kind of be in this in this kind of field of education. And there could be some limits because of your skin color.
I wouldn't be so sure you're so far off professorship. Obviously, you've got to complete the PhD and stuff, but I think so. We had Professor Jason Arday on one of the sister shows on the network called Before Our Friends
Yeah.
Die, and that was a really, really great conversation actually, because he was someone who's been through severe adversity. I don't think he could read until he was like 11, or couldn't speak until he was 11, couldn't read and write till he was
Right.
18.
Yeah.
And then he got a PhD in something ridiculous like 2.5 years. Fascinating story. And what he did is he honed in on his niche, and he honed in on his
Yeah.
strengths. Now you have a unique perspective that higher education, to your point earlier, doesn't particularly see, because that talent pipeline, no, poor
Yeah.
phrase, that academic pipeline is exclusive. There are a lot of barriers for people like yourself and myself.
Yeah.
So generally speaking, the number of us at that stage is limited. So professorship, to my understanding, I asked Professor Jason Arday to define what a professor is, because even though I work in a university, it was a definition that eluded me. Professorship is around that international recognizing of your work and your influence, and
Yeah.
your network could quadruple, I think. You're appearing on shows like this. I can see so many opportunities where we could get you into the University of Northampton, for instance, because like any university, we need young male role models who are in the space and being successful in the space to go and show our students, look, it is possible. Like you said, sometimes you need to see it to believe it, sort of thing. So there's some real, real strong connections for you to be able to make across different universities, and that professorship might come sooner than you think. I hope it does anyway, because I think you've got a lot to add to the sector from hearing you talk right now.
Well, I've got a good few stages up, but just in general, that's kind of eye-opening for myself. Even my mentor, Paul Campbell, someone like him and his accolades and what he's achieved in academia, and to see the lack of opportunities for people like these people who I'm kind of looking up to, what chance have I got eventually?
I spoke at a conference with Paul, and
Yeah.
one of the comments made, not by Paul himself, but actually it might have been by Paul. I think it was by Paul actually. He said, "Well, the things that we're talking about pretty much are a wicked problem, and wicked problems don't get solved by nice solutions. We've got to start being, for lack of a better term, radical in
Yeah,
our approach to
yes.
these solutions." Yeah.
Exactly. And I guess, it's conversations like this that is going to, start that kind of the ball rolling, if you
Yeah.
like. Because again, when we speak about race, it is quite uncomfortable for some people. But it is the reality,
It's the reality.
it's reality, and it's kind of what we kind of believe in, I guess.
So I appreciate that. And thanks for giving that context, because for us, as Sofa Senseis, we're fans of the sport. But, personally, my lens also looks at the sport through a sociology. I look at the way we discuss these fighters, the way we discuss their performances, their identities, and then some of the ways, how to put this, we see it in a lot of the rivalries we see in the sport. Racism forms an element, or race shapes an element of the promotion, whether we like to admit it or not. There
Yeah,
has
of
always
course.
been
Of course.
the hope for a great white hope in the heavyweight division. That is a golden thread that has gone through the promotion. Now, don't get me wrong, it works, right? Because people are invested, and naturally you're going to have an affiliation to certain types of fighters. But that's not really a conversation we've had on the podcast before, so I'm really glad that we can go past that threshold today.
Well, I've got to say, like your kind of breakdowns of the fights and things, I'm enjoying those, and they are, you've got an expert view of some of the fights and some of the breakdowns that you do. So yeah, well done for
Thank you,
that.
man.
I don't know if you if you saw the Tyson Fury press conference with Francis
I
Ngannou.
know where this is going to go. Yeah, I did see it.
Yeah, yeah. See, little things like this. Well, just to explain to the viewers, yeah, Tyson Fury, he made some comments about the size of Francis Ngannou's manhood. Why is he kind of bringing this up? There's a racialized element to these comments, and there must be. Also, the dad, John Fury, he said to KSI, I literally saw this last night, that he looks like a pineapple because of his hair. And already we've seen something similar with Jason Lee in football over the years as well. And because it's, like you said, the Great White Hope, perhaps nothing would be done about this, nothing would be. And I said, what are your thoughts on that?
Do you
I
know
know
what?
you're there.
That's a really interesting question, because I see it on Twitter. I saw a lot of people bringing up that clip, and all they were saying is either ha 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 ha, or they were saying this is old, this is boring from Fury, but no one was picking up the racialized element. And it's that to me is very, very telling of sport, of the sport of boxing, of where we're at. People, what really to draw similar parallels, Colby Covington is a fighter in the UFC who has for a long time traded on race politics in America, particularly, wearing MAGA hats, and we all know the connotations those things have. And he eventually got a fight with Tyron Woodley, who was on a losing streak anyway in his career. In the press conference leading up to that fight, Tyron Woodley wore a shirt that said Black Lives Matter and a hat that said Black Lives Matter, I believe. And all his questions to the whole press conference was Black Lives Matter. So someone would say to him, so Colby has been on a four fight winning streak, whatever. He's wrestling, is high pressure. How are you going to deal with that? And Tyron would respond, I recognize that, I just think Black Lives Matter. And he would just make sure he used his platform to put that message out there. And then some of the reactions to that were, keep race out of sport, keep politics out of sport. Da, 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 da. So the outrage when people center blackness is loud and clear, but that same outrage isn't carried over when it's a negative, effectively. And I know people can talk about the size of manhood, and that can be perceived as a positive. But let's be real; these are potentially dangerous stereotypes.
And if those stereotypes are kind of brought to light, then how's about other stereotypes? Are they just as legitimate
There you go.
as this one?
There you
And
go.
okay, well, okay, black people are less intelligent, then that's the case.
Yeah.
You've got big penises, but you're less intelligent, you may be strong, and
You're just
it's
an animal. You're brutal.
yeah, the brutality of it, yeah.
We see this a lot when certain analysts describe these fighters. And I'm not here to suggest that all of them are rooted in. No, I'm not going to suggest that all of them are overtly racist. But I think they're certainly rooted in racist tropes. The idea that Francis Ngannou is just an animal. He's animalistic. He's all these sort of primal type connotations versus
Of course.
Tyson Fury being a skillful,
Yeah.
slick, intelligent,
Stick up
IQ,
the
skilled technician. The descriptions are different. Now, if you can't see that, then okay, let's agree to disagree. But to me, I certainly see that. And I saw a clip the other day about media training. Don't talk about race, politics, or religion because you alienate 50% of the audience. If you've been alienated by this point, I apologize, but the rest of the podcast is going to continue on this trend because it is a fascinating topic. And this is what we need to talk about. And if it makes you feel uncomfortable, turn it up louder and listen deeper. That's all I've got to say on that one.
And again, there's comparisons to be made. The obvious comparison is with AJ, Anthony Joshua. People are saying, oh, the old AJ, the brutal AJ, the savage AJ. And since he starts boxing, because he's black, oh, we don't want to see that. We want to see the old AJ. That is the best version of AJ, even though he's, more cautious. He boxes intelligently currently, but people don't want to see that. But for Fury, it's fine.
These discussions have dominated sports for decades. I mean, we were speaking
Yes.
offline earlier about I was at a Frank Bruno event last night, and Frank Bruno's career was sort of littered with racialized racialized commentary. You know, the notion that again, brutal, strong heavyweight. A lot of heavyweights back then are marketed positively because of their blackness and the sense that blackness means strength from and that sort of stuff. And then you obviously pitch their rivals as the Great White Hope, as we discussed earlier. But also, Lennox Lewis and Frank Bruno had a clash in the sense that Lennox was calling them an Uncle Tom. And Frank broke down on TV saying, "I'm not an Uncle Tom." But what that meant was when Lennox was standing up for social injustices, Bruno wasn't. Now, that is a whole another layer of conversation in the sense that what responsibility do we have as people of color in the spotlight to comment on social injustices? It's an interesting conversation. I'll probably avoid it for today. We could pick it up in part two if you like, but or we can even explore it today.
We're
But
gonna have to,
you know what I mean? It's one of those things where it is fascinating. It is fascinating, but the media sided with Bruno until Bruno was mentally ill. Because then you start getting headlines, bonkers Bruno. And then you start to reinforce the stereotype that black men, particularly when they are mentally ill, are dangerous and are threats. We see this in the medicalization of mental health of black men, seven times more likely to be sectioned. You know,
Spot on.
it's crazy, but it's very, very fascinating. And then one final example is around Linford Christie. You know, this man is one of the fastest men on the planet in his heyday, and all that's being discussed is his manhood by the media. It's mental. So I might have
It's
hit the
all
nail
over
down on the mic there.
sports. It's all over sports, even with football. That's the same. A lot of examples there.
So let's pick
Sure,
all
go
those
on.
things up within your research and within the context of your research, because it's clear you've got a passion in the field, and I think that shines through. So your research is around the social structures within a local gym serving ethnic minority communities. Now, I can probably guess the answer to this question, but I have to ask it anyway. Is that a conscious decision to pick a gym serving ethnic minority communities?
Yes, it was. I checked out a few gyms prior to actually deciding on this specific gym. And I believe that this gym is the most ethnically diverse within the city of Leicester. Now, it's interesting being, a person of colour going in to research other people of colour. And I felt that that kind of, in a way, helped me kind of blend in and just be a part of their lives for a little bit. So again, that race is so important to this gym. This gym is predominantly Asian, like South Asian, the cohort with some black members also. There's a very few white members that attend, but the actual coaching and the staff of this gym are all African Caribbean. So that is it's a strange dynamic when you look at other boxing gyms, not just in the city but throughout the UK. But it is a place where ethnic minorities are the majority. So going in, as a black researcher, that kind of helped me, I felt. Even some of the, especially the coaches, but also a few of the other members, they would t talk to me openly about race and racism. Especially one of the, well, one specific coach there, he used to talk to me nearly after every session about his past. That he came to, he's one of the first migrants to Leicester from Antigua, and he told me some of his past and what he had to deal with the racism in the 60s and 70s. And this was quite important because these kind of lessons and these kind of, well, the guidance and the advice that these elders and the older culture would give to the young people, that was quite important because that is, it was kind of race specific, how to kind of maneuver through life, you know, being a black or South Asian, you know, person, a person of color. So that, yeah, that was, race is quite central to the study. Again, another finding was that this gym, it kind of reshaped people's identities, their racialized identities, being amongst people that look like themselves, taking advice from coaches that may look like themselves or have been through similar things to yourself as a person of color, that kind of helped them be proud of, I guess, who they were. Now, I noticed that this was significant when they would go away to fights, you know, I guess other gyms, you know, other events. Some people have told me, some participants have told me that they could feel a sense of, I guess, animosity by being a black or brown face in a white space,
right,
when fighting away. But because they're together, you know, as a kind of group, they found strength in that. They found belonging within the gym. So, yeah, they could fight knowing that these people have got their backs, you know, the coaches are there with them. They've also said that they've tried other gyms. Well, a few participants have said this to me. They've tried other gyms, but being amongst people that, you know, a white majority, they felt a little bit different. Now, for some of these people, being amongst, you know, just someone that looks like yourself, someone that you can speak to, and kind of, you know, relate to, you know, that was very important for them. That makes sense, yeah.
So, one of the things that really struck me just then is we've got an episode on the Before Our Friends Die Again with Dr. Marcella Day.
Yeah.
She is an expert in events, travel, tourism, and one of her research centres around the UK domestic tourism of ethnic minorities. And
yeah,
she discovered that 0.01% of the UK domestic tourism market is made up of ethnic minorities. Very, very
okay.
small segment. And right. some of the things she discovered was that if we do engage in UK domestic tourism, we travel in groups because
yeah.
of that same collective safety and sense of belonging
yeah.
when you are in a group. It's fascinating how that transcends not only travel, but other environments and atmospheres too. That is fascinating. I'm seeing the parallels right away. What were some of your findings related to gender and race? Because my little sister, she is a England boxing apprentice, Gabrielle,
yeah.
and she's an amateur boxer. So I'm very, very fascinated if you can give me any insight into how she might be feeling in this space.
Well, you must be proud. Yeah.
Incredibly proud, incredibly yeah, proud. She's yeah. smashing it. And we spar every now and then. And my one rule is body sparring only, please, because she's caught me a few
yeah.
times around the eye, and I had to do a Daniel Dubois and take a knee because yeah, she
yeah.
punched quite hard, bless her. Yeah,
yeah. So again, gender is as central as race to this study. Again, they go hand in hand, they intersect at points also. So, you know, these, I should have mentioned that a lot of, you know, the group, they are South Asian, but a lot of them are actually South Asian females as well. Mm. And the idea of masculinity and femininity, that is quite important in my research. Now, for women specifically, they would try and show this kind of masculine side to their characters, their identity, you know, when training in the gym. So that would be, you know, not showing much emotion, you know, even if you're in pain, you know, when you're training could be hard, and training is so difficult, but again, just suck it up, biting the gum shield. So yeah, they were trying to follow the social norms within this setting. So of course, as a man, you know, you go in there, you try to, you know, reinforce your masculinity through not showing that you're hurt, not, you know, you're, you know, this masculine, this macho person. A lot of the men were like that. Now the women, they were doing similar practices, but the difference was that a lot of the times they didn't really get the respect that they deserve in comparison with the men.
Really?
So yeah, so a couple of the girls, they've said that, you know, these are really good boxers, by the way, but they'd say that some of the men, they're quite reluctant to kind of, you know, hit them in body sparring, for
Right.
example. And admittedly, myself, I was part of that as well. And I've written about this in my field notes. You know, just going against, you know, a woman, it's, you kind of ease back a little bit. You don't want to maybe hurt them. And again, that is kind of a bias that we carry as men. And it's only until I kind of reflected on that when you think, you know why, you know, that there is a bit of
Then you started
split
moving
second
like
sometimes.
Lennox. Then you went in there, the next one, and
But
you went.
yeah, because these women, they can box, they've been boxing for years, and yeah, the fact that they sometimes, some people didn't really give them the respect, like in that sense. Also one of the coaches as well, there is a female coach there. Now when I interviewed her, this coach, she told me that some, especially young boys, they don't really listen to this female coach
Wow.
because of her gender, she believes. So again, you know, female boxing, women's boxing, it's, you know, it's on the up. You
Yeah.
know, there are more and more women that want to box, but you know that there are kind of stereotypes still, and they're at a disadvantage. There are a lot of barriers in there for these women. Again, and it's all kind of mental, and you know, gender is, well, gender inequality is quite rife within the gym. Not on purpose though. You know, people, you know, they treat them well, say hello to them, speak to female members, but I think unconsciously there is a slight difference there. Now, speaking on gender, again, for men, it was a case of, like I says, being macho, being masculine, trying to outdo the opposition in sparring, or in body sparring. You know, if you can get one over on your mate, you know, you're going to feel good about yourself. Now, interestingly, because I said, you know, race and gender, they do intersect at points. There was an idea that new identities were formed in relation to race and gender. So for the South Asian females, you know, in society, they were kind of seen as, you know, kind of fragile and kind of passive, and you know, they shouldn't really be in this space in the first place. Now, a lot of these wanted to prove people wrong. They wanted to create a new form of kind of identity, say that I am strong and I can train and I can defend myself. I can, you know, self-defense. I'm equipped to deal with that. So they were building new forms of a South Asian woman. Also, the idea of femininity for them in the gym, it wasn't so important. So they would come in, you know, no makeup, just baggy clothes, and they'd be happy to do that. And this was a safe space to do that. I know in other sports you may have to, you know, look the part perhaps, and then, or maybe at the professional level, because I know some boxers are getting by, maybe because on their appearance,
Yeah, it's a big part of their
maybe
profile.
Ebbing and Bridges, for example. But for these South Asian women, they came in, put in the hard work, and wanted to create strong female identities. Yes.
So one of the things that I wanted to pick up on is you talk about the construction of urban identities. Now that piques my interest because naturally, as we understood from Wakant's Body and Soul, not all of these people are going to be boxers. Some people are just training for training's sake, enjoying it, you know, getting stuck in, that self-development piece we spoke about earlier. Now, how does boxing, race, gender, and all these things you looked at create, forge a urban identity? Why is that significant?
Yeah, so with urban identities, it is a case of kind of reshaping urban identities. I should really explain, because you know, some of these kids, they're coming into the boxing gym, nothing going for them, and you know, they're trying to re-represent this identity of an urban self. So that could mean, I know there's one kid who was telling me that he'd always get in trouble. He's on the wrong side of the law, and this gym was actually helping him to find discipline, okay, and to kind of recenter himself as something positive. But again, it's not trying to strip away, you know, perhaps like a street mentality, perhaps, but instead it's kind of reshaping that to better deal with the outside world. I don't know if that
does make sense, yeah. Because, like I said, we spoke to a lot of boxers on this show, and some of the things that they come out with are around that discipline, that structure, that lifestyle. And inevitably, in urban environments, you're going to encounter certain situations, and having that boxing as a support mechanism or as a framework through which you see the world can allow you to navigate those systems a little bit better. I also think as well, one of the things I wanted to pick up on is that inclusion exclusion piece, because when we've spoken to boxers, only one of them, from my memory, has told us about being excluded from a gym. Every other single one has spoken about all people being welcome. So I'm wondering what your reflections are on that. And to give you some context, the one who was excluded was Rhys Taylor. He was at one point the UK's shortest pro boxer. He's now retired. Wow. So I think he's something like 4'11". I could be wrong. It could be slightly shorter than that. Okay. But yeah, he was told explicitly by a coach, yeah, we're not going to train you. So that's the one piece of exclusion we've heard.
Yeah, when it comes to inclusion and exclusion, this gym, it was more about including those who are usually or typically excluded. Again, the South Asian woman.
Yeah.
Now, just looking at, you know, the sports participation. I can't read off the stats off the top of my head, but I know that South Asian women are the most, the least active of all social groups within the country. So this was about getting these people involved. The gym, it even runs some, you know, women's only sessions just for women. And I know a lot of Muslim women attend that. Because again, you know, with culture, it is a case of, you know, gives you an opportunity to be active without being in the presence of men and, you know, covering themselves. So little things like that, and that is giving those who are usually excluded, it's giving them an opportunity. And again, I've already mentioned kind of, you know, other gyms and, you know, feeling of belongingness here for these people, for this community, you know, they're everyone's welcome. And it's not just these gym sessions that are that are helping these people feel included. They also run different events,
Wow.
charity events, workshops. So even the local community, they're trying to, be inclusive to everyone pretty much, and put these kind of charity days, fun days out to the community, and so people can come along, have some fun, buy some food, and just kind of integrate together.
So
So that.
I think for me, there is a few sort of final pieces to pick up on then on this one.
Yeah, sure.
So we've spoken about your research. What's the sort of like practically, what's the timeline on this? What, how far are you into this research?
Okay, so yeah, I'm out of the field of. I'm pretty much putting the final touches on the actual, well, my thesis.
Nice.
The research part of this is pretty much done. I spent the last couple of years, 18 months to 2 years or so, at this gym, and so yeah, I've taken field notes. I've interviewed all the participants. All of that's pretty much done. Now it's just a case of writing, the final chapters, and presenting it, I guess. So
So
I'm going towards the end.
just to offer an opportunity there, if you wanted to present it to a captive audience,
Yeah.
the University of Northampton, I'm sure will be, I will make sure we are open to that, as are the Atkins Office Digital Network. So
Yeah,
yeah, we could
I'd
pick
like
that
to do that,
up.
yeah.
Yeah, we can
That'd be brilliant.
that'll be our first ever presentation. That'll be very interesting. I'll think of a way we can do that. But one of the final things I wanted to pick up on then is I'll ask in this order. First of all, one thing we've sort of skipped over throughout this conversation has been your experience in this space, in the sense of how did you find the training? You mentioned body sparring a few times, you yourself getting stuck in. How was it to follow the boxer's lifestyle for 2 years? Give us some reflections around that.
Well, for me, it was a case of, this is what I love, to be honest. I love boxing. Even if I wasn't doing this piece of research, I'd still be at a gym boxing. Like even now, I'll box like a couple times a week. So the passion for it is there. So although I was there for kind of, on a professional kind of basis, it was pretty much kind of a hobby for me at the same time. So I enjoy kind of working alongside these people, and also meeting these people. I've actually made some friends at the gym as well. So again, it is a case of getting there for research purposes and seeing what the gym's about, seeing what the people are about. But personally, yeah, I've made a lot of friends. Of I'm going to keep in contact with some of these people. Again, I still use the gym, and yeah, so it's been great, to be honest.
And you didn't fancy a couple amateur bouts or, white collar?
Okay, so here's the thing. I was actually like I've been training at a gym in Nottingham before this, prior to this, and I moved to Leicester for this thesis, and ethics wouldn't allow me to box for this gym, or well, box at the gym even,
Fair
because
enough,
it's dangerous. It's dangerous. So yeah, there were plans on getting into some fights, probably for another gym. Yeah, for another gym.
Well, hit us up if you need a sponsor or you need a promoter, not promoter, but
Yeah, that'd
promoting.
be great.
We'll sort that out. All right, one of the final things, and we've alluded to it throughout this conversation, we haven't touched on it fully. I just want to get your views on, we talk about books, boxing. A lot of them focus on the neurological damage associated with boxing. What are your thoughts? And the particular book that I've read on this subject is Tris Dixon's Damage. I find it a really, really fascinating book. And just wanted to get any of your reflections, either from being in the gym or as a spectator or participant, even. What are your thoughts on damage in boxing?
On brain damage.
Yes.
Okay, yeah, so it's so here's the thing. It's a big part of me, you know, I do love boxing and I love to see the knockout. But when you look at the bigger picture, you've got to ask yourself, is it worth it? Is it worth it? And no, it's not worth it, to be honest. And that's kind of what,
It's controversial
yeah,
on this show. Yeah.
it is, you know. And I'm a big boxing fan. I'm there screaming at the TV to,
Yeah, real
you
talk,
know,
yeah.
yeah. But it's, but when you really kind of look deep into it, it isn't worth it. Now, again, we could probably say this till for part two, but I lost my dad last year,
Sorry to hear
and
that.
he got it. Yeah, no, it's fine. And he had a bleed to the brain, and I thought, wow, this is it's kind of opened my eyes to, you know, how kind of precious life is. And a win in boxing, how much do you kind of how much do you value that? Do
What's it
you
worth?
value it
Yeah.
over? Yeah, potentially you could get a blow to the brain, your brain could bleed, and it's happened numerous times. Is that worth it? Now, for some people, okay, if you're fighting for a world title, you're going to earn millions of pounds, your family's going to be safe. Yeah, why not? But for perhaps the average person like myself, I'm thinking, is it worth at least losing brain cells? Or, but again, like you said, it's quite controversial. I'm a huge advocate for boxing, but the reality says that it is quite dangerous, and you know, there's kind of bigger consequences there for, you know, getting punched to the head. It's brutal. Yeah.
Some of the people we've spoken to about this have you know said that boxing has saved more lives than it's taken,
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I see that argument. I do watch some fights though, and I think, wow, you're really, really putting your life on the line, both short term and long term.
Yeah.
And put it this way, it's not a decision I would make, but that's why I'm me and they are them. Because those people are different. They're different. You have to have a
Yeah, I
screw
get it. I get
slightly
it. Yeah.
loose, and I think that's why I love it, because I see these people who are willing to do things, willing to go places I wouldn't go, and I try, I guess, to live vicariously through
Yeah.
them.
Yeah.
Look, I've created a whole show around these people. You know what I mean? It's mental, but I do. Particularly when you can see fighters aren't what they used to be, and that likely that is because they've spent a lot of themselves in the ring. Oh, it's horrible. But when it's good, it's good, and when it's bad, it's dreadful.
That's
And
it,
that's
yeah.
boxing.
You know, it is a part of, you know, who they are, I guess. And some people would, you know, throw out on your shield, as the saying goes, and
Go out on your shield, man. For what? For what?
that's
Yeah,
it.
I know. I hear it though. I hear it, but yeah, you're right. Questions around is it worth it are really, really interesting in this sport, and I think we could probably speak for hours on it, because there's an iceberg of worth itness. That's not the word I'm looking for, but of worthiness. That's what I'm looking for. Yeah, there's an iceberg of it. AJ, 30 mil a fight. Maybe you do get your head punched in once or twice, and he's good enough to defend. You know, da, 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 da.
Sign me up.
Yeah, do you know what I'm saying? But to be AJ, you have to fight for what? 13, 14 years? Hundreds, thousands of rounds of sparring? Not paid?
Is it worth? That's exactly why, when you asked me the question, you know, will you be fighting? That's why I was a little bit, you know, on the fence when I kind of answered the question. And, you know, that kind of goes through my head. Is it worth it? Is it worth it?
I was speaking to my brother yesterday while we were watching watching Frank Bruno, well, Frank Bruno Foundation fights, and he said to me, "Oh, do you never get like the itch? Do you never not want to get in there?" And I says, "Yeah, but equally, I don't know how much rope I've got on this brain. Yeah, it could be one punch that finishes me off. Yeah, I might have a chin. I don't know, but I don't want to test that for free. You know, like I don't want to test that unless my life is really on the line."
It's
yeah.
yeah, I get that. I get that. When I was training in Nottingham, I used to spar pretty much every day,
Head spar as well.
and head spar, well, mainly body sparring, but head sparring at least maybe 2 to 3 times a week. And for me, I was enjoying it, and it was the thrill of just trading blows. And afterwards, I'd feel a bit,
Affected.
a bit affected, yeah. And again, I was trying to save your brain cells, to be honest. But yeah, it's definitely something that you should really think about. I think for the boxers that are kind of starting out, I think they should really think about the long term, and what's the long term plan, and what's it going to take to get there.
Let's be real though. If they think about the long-term plan, they ain't doing it because I've probably thought myself out of it. Simple as that. There's no way I can undo those thoughts now. Of like, I was at the fairground maybe a year ago now, and it was a simple ride. It was just one of those swings that go up and up and up and up and up. And up. Got to the top, and I'm thinking, no, what are we doing? What am I doing? What am I doing? Because if I fall, I'm gonna, break my back, break my legs, my hips are going to be finished, I might die. And because I'm getting older and I'm getting more wary of my own not immortality, mortality, I'm thinking I shouldn't be putting my life at this level of risk. And that just means that now I've thought myself out of plenty of adrenaline junkie activities. What did I bottle? Oh yeah, I bottled a, I should, probably shouldn't admit this on the podcast, should I? But I bottled a zip line over Niagara Falls a couple months ago. Yeah, I just thought to myself, yeah, but if I fall out, right, that's it, it's
people.
over, it's over. And realistically, in that headspace, you shouldn't do it. And I'll go back there and I'll psych myself up some way somehow, and I'll say to myself, ah, just do it, yeah. And then I'll enjoy it and I'll be safe, I'm sure. But point is, the mind is very, very powerful. And if you're going to be a boxer in your early stages, you better go in there thinking it's going to take you a few fights to become world champion and you're going to be perfectly safe. Otherwise, if you go in there gun shy, you're going to get hurt. Yeah, it's crazy.
You need that right mentality
Yeah.
to, well, to even step foot in the ring, I guess. I've got
For
to take
sure.
my hats off to those who do.
Absolutely.
But yeah, for sure.
Well, it's not head guards for you, it's mortar boards, and it's a pleasure to see. Congratulations on all those accolades. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah,
Really
thank you.
appreciate it.
Been a pleasure.
That has been Sofa Sensei's, one of the most thrilling conversations we've had on this show. So thank you so much to Christian for joining us. Really appreciate it. I've been Kavan. This is the Aki and Saltfish Digital Network. And don't forget, you can connect with us any social media, TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, or X, I should say, I suppose. We're on all of those things, either as Aki and Saltfish or Sofa Sensei, so make sure you check us out. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel and do all those great things like share this with a friend and leave us a 5-star review, because it helps us grow and that really, really matters. Finally, Christian, if people want to connect with you, where can they go?
So Twitter, Chris Joe Davis. That's what I mainly use. Also Instagram, Chrissy underscore Joe 3. That's CRISSY underscore JOE3. Get me at the socials, hit me up, and keep watching the pod. It's a great pod. Well done, Evan.
Appreciate it. Thank you very, very much. And he's right. Keep watching it, because this time next week, we will be chatting to Chris about the 7 signature questions we have for all of our, say, fighters, but all of our guests on this show and other shows. So make sure you stick around and check it out. Thank you very much. Take care and goodbye.